This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. The election is coming up, and there are two candidates running for city council in Morro Bay.
I attended the candidates' night when you guys spoke. What I'm missing is, how are you guys opponents?
Also, Festival Mosaic's summer concerts start in June.
The heart of it is a chamber music festival, mm-hmm. but we really embrace that sort of mosaic name with the idea that when we do explore other genres, we are trying to bring some of the very best that we can.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, May 16th, 2022. I'm Carol Tangeman. Let's start with Around Downtown.
For KCBX Issues and Ideas, this is Bettina Swigger with our monthly segment called Around Downtown. Full disclosure, in addition to being your friendly radio host, I am also the CEO of Downtown Slow, the placemaking business improvement area in downtown San Luis Obispo. On today's episode, we are going to be talking with Robin Elander, my counterpart in Santa Barbara, who is the executive director at Downtown Santa Barbara. Robin, how are you doing today? Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm doing great. This is exciting. It's so nice to chat with you again.
I know, it's been a minute, and I think things are a little bit different and a little bit, dare I say, better than the last time we spoke.
Definitely better. Oh my goodness. We spoke in the middle, the depth of the pandemic. So we're in a different place. I mean, there's still some challenges for sure, but definitely in a different place.
And you came into your role during the pandemic or just before, is that correct?
I did. It was May 7th, 2020. I just surpassed 2 years in my role just this past week. So
congratulations.
Thank you so much.
So how do things look now 2 years into your role? That's actually a better placeholder than 2 years into the pandemic.
Well, you know, things are in a really exciting spot downtown. So we made a lot of changes with our State Street condition during the pandemic that have turned into a really fortuitous experiment that ultimately created a pretty significant section of downtown as a pedestrian area. So no cars, except for the cross-through streets, still cars can go through there. And it has initiated a process where the city's going into a full master planning process to develop downtown utilizing this space, either in its current condition or, you know, slightly changed condition for, you know, the years ahead. So that's been initiated. A huge group of a State Street Advisory Committee, which is like a planning group, has come together, a selection of, I think it's 15 or so movers and shakers in the community to help develop that. I'm one of the people on that. So it's a lot of interesting things are coming out of, you know, a challenging moment.
And for our listeners, can you explain what is Downtown Santa Barbara and how do you relate to the city and how do the puzzle pieces all fit together?
Downtown Santa Barbara, or Downtown Organization of Santa Barbara, is a nonprofit organization that supports and promotes about 1,400 businesses in our downtown business improvement district. So it was started back in the 70s by a team of business owners, and they wanted to initiate the business improvement district ultimately to support and promote downtown. And then they created a business assessment district ultimately to put a fee on the business license that is collected by the city and then ultimately goes to us to kind of manage this area, at least in certain capacities. So that's how we operate. We are not part of the city government, but we work very closely in collaboration on a lot of things.
And what are the geographical boundaries of that district?
Mitchell Terena to Gutierrez and Chapala to Anacapa Street.
For context, San Luis Obispo, we have a similar arrangement We're also a business improvement area, and we have about 600 businesses. So about half of the businesses that you have in Santa Barbara, a little bit smaller footprint, but the same kind of model. And these models exist all over the country and certainly all over California. Of course, the State Street is really, I think, the big headline that most people are learning about. I had the opportunity to experience it a couple of times. It's so vibrant and fun. And I'm just curious, how do things look? Are you looking to have that be a permanent thing? What will the master planning process look like? And what will State Street look like 2 years from now?
Really good question. So I think it's certainly a work in progress, but there's a lot of interest in keeping all or a section of the current 13 blocks that are currently closed, two cars, but rethinking about how the different space is used. So right now, the main way the space is used is for outdoor dining and also for special events, music, those types of things. And so over time, I think the idea of the master plan may be to have more of a park-like kind of atmosphere. There may be different street treatments, whether that is artistic designs or potentially raising the street up to the sidewalk. And so there's less issues around design. You know, it was designed to use as a regular street. And so now if it's something that people want to keep in more of a pedestrian atmosphere, they're thinking about all of those elements, whether it has a trolley, whether it is stays all close to cars, or if we open, you know, sections of it, will it be one way in sections? So it's the verdict is out. Currently we have the city council has decided to keep the street closed as is until, and well, maybe, I mean, there's some changes that can take place. They keep using the terms and we all keep saying this is temporary, but they've created an ordinance that stays in this condition, or at least some version of it, till December 2023.
Wow, that's a good stretch. Okay.
It is. So we've got about a year and a half more of this unique experiment to continue different elements. And during that entire time, that's also when the master planning process is going to go alongside of it. Big process has been initiated. Still a lot of time will be needed to figure out all of the way that it will look, but it has been a great way to attract people back to town and also, you know, to come downtown who are locals, but also increase our tourism to the degree that which it is actually either right about back to where it was before COVID, or in some cases, much above it in some areas. So people are really enjoying the space and are enjoying strolling with their families and friends and that kind of thing. What did you guys decide to do, and how's it working?
So we have a little bit of a different system here in San Luis Obispo. So rather than having streets closed to vehicles, when we closed our streets in San Luis Obispo, people expected the farmers market, which is this huge event that draws thousands of people. And so when it wasn't that, it felt a little bit sort of disappointing. So, and it didn't feel quite as novel, I think, because we had this institution that had been going back for so many decades. The farmers market here started in 1983 until it stopped in March of 2020. So we've been able to bring that back. We just celebrated 1 year back in operation for that. And it's really grown in popularity. We adjusted some of our vendor types so that we're inviting different types of entrepreneurs to participate. And it's been a wonderful program. But in terms of outdoor dining, we do have a parklet program that's being evaluated currently. The city council will be evaluating this and voting on it in July. And there's a public information process that's happening right now. So last week we had a session with our businesses where we invited city officials from the active transportation program and the public works department to talk about what it would look like to develop a plan where these parklets could become permanent. So there would be design guidelines in place. There would be hours of operation to be required for use, so they're not sitting empty. And, you know, there would be a fee that would be charged to the business, because the businesses have been able to operate on public property because this came up during the emergency. And now there needs to be some kind of compensation to make up for lost revenue and parking, as well as the expense that the city takes on to clean and maintain those spaces. So it's an interesting moment because at first, everybody was very in favor of the parklets, right? And it was such a great way to try to support the local economy. Predominantly, people still really love it, but there are people who maybe have changed their tune a little bit and want to see them be a little bit cleaner, a little bit neater. And maybe the bloom has come off of that rose just a bit. Curious if you've had a similar experience with State Street.
We have. You know, there was this quite a long amount of time that it was just new, exciting. And now that it's a little bit, now we're kind of starting to work on the nitty-gritties of some of the issues and challenges that have come out of it. And there are quite a number. But one of them is how to, similar to what you're saying, is, you know, the businesses so far have been able to operate outside on the public property, either on a side street in a parklet condition, or we just call it outdoor dining on State Street where the street is closed. But both are kind of the beginnings of conversations about how to turn this into a more permanent program and have a fee associated, and how often to move those structures or make them portable so that things like parades and cleaning can take place on a regular basis. So that is a conversation that's going on right now. The city has developed a, what they're calling a subcommittee of three council members to, you know, discuss some of these issues that are arising, particularly around those outdoor dining spaces. And, you know, here, from businesses who don't have those access, you know, a need to create some fairness there, like you said.
Yeah, it's an interesting point too, right? Because I remember before the pandemic, there were a lot of conversations about making pedestrian-friendly spaces and more plazas. And both of our downtowns have really beautiful public space in them already. But I'm curious to see too, what your experience is. There's a lot of focus obviously on the restaurants and the bars, which are a huge reason why people come to downtown environments, but we have a lot of retail storefronts and brick and mortar retail as well. How is the retail doing in Santa Barbara?
You know, it's a mix. We've actually had some businesses end up going out of business. Others, we have had quite a number, something like 60 new businesses that have come into downtown in the past year, not all retailers. But fortunately, some we've had this weekly market that some businesses have come out of that and ended up getting into brick and mortars, which has been one of our success stories out of that. But the retail, in combination with some of this other things, it's a real mix. I think we've had a lot of learning curve in terms of before, when you're able to drive past a business, you know, some guests or visitors who are coming into town, they were used to getting sort of that certain type of drive-by traffic, and they got used to a certain way they did business, which is different with, you know, the pedestrian version. And places like furniture stores needed to try to figure out how to do business in this new environment. And when they didn't have, like, people could come by and just, you know, plop a couch in the back of a truck. Well, with the street closed in full, that has to be done only in certain hours of the day. And it's just kind of gotten more complicated. We have figured out most of those little issues, but it's still a work in progress. You know, it's the businesses that have done, the retailers that have done well, have created partnerships with a lot of the restaurants or are near to the restaurants, so that there's kind of this mutually beneficial relationship with, you know, you're going out to dinner and you're going shopping. But there are some blocks that don't have as many restaurants, and our retailers have suffered, unfortunately. And we have some areas that have a number of vacancies on a couple blocks. So we are at one particular block, one and a half, that's kind of a strong situation that we're trying to navigate. So, you know, there's been a number of pros and cons associated, things to work out.
The thing that really stuck out to me is the adjective you used, where you described the situation as complicated. And I like that because
yes, it's complicated.
It's not necessarily simple or difficult. It's just complicated. And right. Yeah, that definitely is familiar to me as well. And, you know, we have colleagues who work in downtown organizations across the country. And I think both of us are in some ways better off than a lot of our counterparts in major metropolitan areas, where we don't have skyscrapers full of offices that have been abandoned because of work from home and storefront retail that is impacted as much, although I'm sure you probably have a little bit of that. I am wondering how
good amount, definitely not skyscrapers, but we have had a lot of office workers, you know, choose to not come back or kind of are in a different place. But unexpected situation has been that a lot more people have moved to town. So from major metropolitan areas like New York City or San Francisco, where although Santa Barbara is still expensive, it's less than there. And now people are working from here, which is good in a lot of regards, but bad in the fact that it's not necessarily bad, but it's a situation that has occurred, making our housing market and our rental market even more complicated, and has all just kind of gone up and made a lot of the businesses that usually have access to employees who can afford to rent here even harder to stay. So that has gotten more complicated. Have you found some of those kinds of things going on there as well?
It's as if you are saying what is inside of my brain. Yes, definitely. We face similar challenges, and it's in many ways, it's wonderful because when you have people who choose to live in a community, it makes an intentional community, right? I've lived in places where people just live there because, oh, well, this is where I'm from and I don't have any other options. When you live in a destination, whether that's for tourists or people who make the decision to live in a place, it means that they can be more engaged in decision-making and they can make wonderful things happen in community. But it also makes it really hard for all aspects of the economy to operate fairly and equitably. And definitely the housing challenges are very, very real. I'm not quite sure we're going to be able to solve that challenge. Do you have a lot of residents in your downtown, or is it predominantly retail, restaurant, office space?
It's more business commercial use. There's an effort to create more housing downtown. There are a number of projects under development or soon to be under development. And actually even a new temporary transition housing for homeless actually as well. So there's probably about 4 to 5 different market or affordable housing situations, plus this other one that I mentioned. So there's a lot in the works. It's a constant conversation about how to open more doors, streamline the process to be able to build more apartments and or houses downtown.
It's an interesting challenge, but at the same time, there's great opportunity when you bring in more residents into a downtown because it creates that 24/7 resident who is keeping an eye on things and, you know, visiting your shops and dining in your restaurants and maybe attracting, dare I say, a grocery store, things that people always ask me about. Do you get the grocery store question?
We actually have a number of grocery stores in the surrounding areas, not really right on the main sort of corridor, but we have one block off, and then we have kind of a couple specialty grocery stores. So it's not as much of a conversation here.
Okay. Well, maybe I was projecting for that one.
I am curious though, what kinds of learnings or takeaways have you really had during this time? If you could share anything that either other downtowns or I can learn from along the way.
Sure. I mean, I think it's every day we learn something new. So that's one of the things I really love about this work. We've been really fortunate. We've had a number of businesses open, a number of new businesses, and our vacancy rate is pretty low in our downtown. We have a couple of very large stores that were vacated by longtime businesses. And I say this, it's like when a little kid loses the 2 front teeth in their smile and you just see it. So those are definitely visible, but we have a lot of new businesses that have opened, including some that have moved from smaller locations into larger locations within the downtown. And I think that really speaks to the success there. Everything from offices to retailers to restaurants. And it's fun to see that. I think the other big thing that's come up is that we've always been known as a community that is definitely a tourist community, but also is fiercely loyal to its local businesses. And that has come out so much. The whole conversation around shop local, it's not just a slogan. People really have made a commitment to that. And you see it. And I see it in the commitment that the businesses have made to our downtown as well. It's pretty cool.
That's awesome. That's great to hear.
We have a roller rink in operation right now, which is super fun. I highly recommend a roller rink.
They're coming back. We have a roller rink in development right now that's about to open. The Aloha Fun Center is a semi-permanent roller rink that's it's actually at the base of an old Macy's, believe it or not. So that's been a unique thing. So I'm interesting to hear that that's something going on there as well.
Just these sort of moments of surprise and delight that really are why people come to downtowns and sort of stumble into something and find a shop they didn't know existed and maybe run into a friend they hadn't seen in a while too. How about the tourism?
Our cruise ship program has finally come back in the next two-ish months. And so we have an ambassador program that's done in collaboration with the city and the local chamber. And so a number of volunteer ambassadors tell folks getting off the cruise ships, hey, these are different things that you can do downtown and opportunities with that. So we have, I believe, 17 cruise ships that have been in town in the last bit, and probably about 10 more coming up that have like anywhere from 4,000 people to, you know, 1,500 people per day coming in. So that's been a real boon coming back. And some of those are weekday and some of them are weekend.
Well, I hadn't even thought about the cruise ships. That's got to be visible. I mean, you must see people. And can you recognize them? Like, oh, those are the cruise people?
You can kind of tell. Often there's a wristband. There's just usually like a horde at once because they're getting off a bus at like five different stops. And you can hear when the cruise ship arrives, there's a sort of a low horn honking thing that happens, and it just like exudes over all of downtown. It depends on the way that the fog is coming in. And so you can hear it and you can also hear it departing. So it's kind of this really interesting return of something that had been going on for so many years, but then it was 2 years of them not coming. And so certain businesses really benefited quite significantly. And so that's nice to have that back, but that wasn't something that I was attuned to so much before, but now, strangely enough, I can actually hear that horn honking in the morning when I'm waking up, when it gets into town, like at 7 in the morning, and I'm like, okay, do we have enough staff to be ambassadors for that thing? Okay, yes. Yeah. Oh, there's a cruise ship again.
Wow. Well, this job always is coming with new surprises of things that you didn't know were wonderful opportunities.
That would be one of them for sure.
Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. This has been Robin Elander, the Executive Director of Downtown Santa Barbara, and Bettina Swigger, your host for Issues and Ideas. I'm also the CEO of Downtown San Luis Obispo.
The special municipal election in the city of Morro Bay is on Tuesday, June 7th, and there are two candidates vying for a seat on the city council. KCBX's Tom Wilmer spoke with the candidates.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Morro Bay, California. Come along and join me for a conversation with two contenders for a special municipal election for city council in Morro Bay. James Costanzo, hi. And Jen Ford. Let's start with you, James. How did it all come about, you deciding to run for city council?
Thanks for having us here, Tom.
Sure,
I appreciate it. I'm a big fan. I've listened to a lot of your podcast, man, the Salinan Indians, as you did here on the coast. It was great. And this is my least favorite subject, talking about myself. You know, I've been involved with the city. I always follow what the council does and everything. And I was a big fan of Red Davis as well.
Oh, yeah.
So,
pushed on recently.
Yeah, sadly to say. Mm-hmm. But there was nobody else stood up. I think we need choices in town. So,
what is the core and the nut of what drove you to say, yeah, I'm willing to do this?
Well, the way the council has been going, I wasn't too fond of. I didn't like that direction that they were going. That's why. That, and there was nobody else, so I thought we'd give them a choice.
So you want to turn the direction of the ship.
I do, and we give a little bit of balance to the council, a little bit of balance back. And I attended a lot of council meetings over the years, you know, the past 15. You know, I've always interested. They were doing stuff to the power plant when Duke Energy first bought that, you know, after PG&E sold it. So that piqued my interest, that, and the wastewater plant. Cool. You know, there was a lot of controversy over that over the years. We spent a lot of time on that. That went back and forth, as you know.
It's still not a done deal.
It's not.
What happens with the stacks and the battery storage and
There's a lot of issues that face us here in Morro Bay.
Jen Ford, what brought you to the table?
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for having us here. I have a couple of reasons why I'm here today. The first is that I've been involved with our community for over 10 years, from PTA president to being an activist in our community to being a part of other organizations and hiring panels and committees to give advice for fundraising and advice to our city manager, just a lot of different roles that I've played within our city and our county. And getting involved and listening to our council meetings and public speaking at those council meetings and attending other advisory boards, it was just kind of the natural progression of things. I was appointed to Planning Commission, was there for actually a short while before the passing of Robert Red Davis, our beloved council member and good friend. And when that occurred, I knew that someone needed to step in. And actually, the council member, past council member, asked me to run for his position. So, of course, I had to think long and hard about that one because I'm a businesswoman. I run a business. I'm a mother. And would I have time for this? And that was a big question mark. And so I had the opportunity to apply for the appointment. And when I got that, I got the unique opportunity to be your sitting council member since then, since September of 2021.
And the term of office is how long?
It is the rest of Red Davis's term, which ends in 2024. So James and I are running for the rest of that term.
That's enough time to get in trouble. James, in a hit list, priority 1, 2, 3, if you could accomplish one thing, two things, what would they be?
Well, first of all, I want the community to be more involved. And for them to be more involved, they need to know what the city's doing. So the city needs to do a better, we're going to call it outreach. So the citizens know what's going on.
And how do you do that? Is it getting people to attend city council meetings?
I'd like to see more people attend city council meetings, you know. So I'd like to get them more involved. We have these ad hoc committees, you know, get people more involved. And the city needs to listen to that. Mm-hmm. I think there's been a little bit of disconnect. And, of course, with the pandemic and everything. But even before that, we knew better what the city was doing and the direction it was going in. So I want to bring that back. So ask the questions not only of the city employees, but bring that into the city council meetings so everybody knows what's going on. See, I've been doing these city council meetings. You know, I should know a lot. I've been to a lot of these council meetings, so I should be really up to date. And you know what? I'm not. I'm finding out I'm not. I got to do a lot more research. So that's one reason.
Okay, so you have the citizenry involved. Now what?
Implement what they want, you know, because I don't have an agenda. So we get the feedback from the public to see what issues are important to them and how to solve these problems.
You guys both must have garnered a lot of feedback from the community already. What's on top of the citizens' list?
People are concerned with this WRF and how we're going to complete it.
What is that?
The wastewater treatment plant. You know, there's a lot of different things going on with that plant, and we want to see it. Just as a citizen, seeing how the work is being done, you know, maybe raises a couple of questions, and people have voiced that.
What would be a primary, most important question people are asking?
As far as the whole thing on the city?
Yeah.
I don't think there's just one, because we have that.
Back to the water.
Are we going to finish it on budget? And as we know, we're already $20 million over budget. And so I know there's been talk about another $218, which is a vote on raising the tax for that. I don't think people are up for that. So that's one concern.
Already, I mean, it's sticker shock what
Certainly.
We pay every month in water sewage. I mean, that's extraordinary. Is there any thought of subsidizing that or bringing those costs down to the taxpayer?
Well, they haven't discussed that yet.
But that's something that I absolutely imagine a lot of people, especially retired fixed income people, that's painful.
Very painful. Yeah, I remember when it was $40 for both water and sewer. You know, that doesn't seem that long ago.
No, and I think we pay $180 a month.
Yes.
I mean, that's a huge difference.
A huge difference. You know, and if you would look at Cayucas and what Cayucas was able to do, they already have their plant up and running, and it was in well within budget. So I think we shot for the moon, so to speak, you know, and it's not done yet. So we're still doing the injection wells. So that's another thing. We're doing a pilot well to see how that's going to work. So there's a lot of unanswered questions yet, even before we get to the end of that. And we're not only over budget, but the timeline has changed, so we're not sure when it's going to actually be completed. They say at the end of the year, but we're going to cross our fingers, you know. Yeah.
Jen Ford, top of your list.
Well, I like to say that completing this wharf at the wastewater reclamation facility, getting that wastewater reclamated is really important. But time is money. I've mentioned this many times. We need to finish this project, as soon as possible. But I wasn't involved in the development of this wastewater treatment plant. I was brought in September. And so, you know, really, I feel the role of our council is to review what comes forward in front of us, to do our homework, to meet with staff, and to do what we can to make the best decisions moving forward. And as James said, just completing this project hopefully on time. But I would say that other projects that people are concerned about is the battery energy storage system. That's a hot topic. You'll hear it is referred to as BESS. And that is something that I can't really necessarily give you like an opinion on whether or not I think it should happen because it...
Well, explain what it is briefly.
Yeah, the battery storage system, what it would do is it would store energy for up to 4 hours. And it helps when we have... Well, it helps in a couple of different ways. It stores energy for when we have less energy in the system, and so it helps alleviate brownouts and hopefully blackouts and that sort of thing. We're also looking at less energy in the near future if Diablo is fully decommissioned. There's talks there too. So, but anyway, if that happens, we really need to get creative in our ways of clean energy, sustainable energy, moving forward with our future for generations to come.
That dovetails to off-coast wind generation that is in the talk stage right now.
Yeah, it is. That'll be very helpful. So that battery technology will help with solar. So when the sun's not shining, we have that extra power to get us through until daylight, so to speak. So it's a great technology. And I think there's a long way to go on that.
And the criticism has to do with fire and explosions.
Exactly. All we have to do is look to the north of us at Moss Landing. You know, they're having a time of it up there. So that's why I don't think the technology, I think it's still coming up to speed, you know, to make that a real viable option. I'm for that technology. It's just the spot to where they want to put it. I'm not in favor of that. You know, it's not coastal dependent for the battery as the power plant was coastal dependent, you know, with the outflow, the intake of the water.
So since we're talking about the old PG&E plant, the stacks, the iconic image of Morro Bay for some, what's the latest on that? What's going to happen to the stacks?
From what I understand is there's that deal within that battery and the property that's going to happen there.
That's a condition.
That's a condition. They said that this, you know, we'll do this. And the city said, yes, if you want to, you're going to demolish that existing plant, that the stacks will come down. Or the city had an option of keeping the stacks, but they would be responsible for the upkeep of that and the maintenance on that, which with our budget, I don't think that would be very prudent to do.
And I would just like to say that was one of the first decisions I got to make on council was, as James has mentioned, to vote to allow Vistra to take down the stacks at their own discretion, because if we had not necessarily demanded but asked that they keep them, they were willing to do so. But as he said, we would have to be responsible for them financially. And it was just a risk that was too high for myself to take for our future generations. When I make decisions, I think about the now, but I also think about 40 years from now and what does that look like? And I have two daughters that I want to hopefully feel like they can come back and live here if they want to in the future. And I want it to be a place that they can live in 40 years. And so responsibility to take care of the stacks that really at this point have zero use other than nostalgia was just an irresponsible decision to make if I had said keep them.
Okay, one more from the constituency issues that are of importance to the citizenry.
Well, one of the things that I hear a lot is they want the council to focus on the issues of Morro Bay. You know, all the problems of Morro Bay, our streets, our failing streets, and the infrastructure for the wastewater system too. The WRF is different than our old infrastructure, so it doesn't address that.
And WRF?
The WRF.
Is?
The wastewater treatment plant. Yeah. That's what everybody refers it to, or the wharf. But when I think of the wharf, I think of the waterfront. But the WRF, as we call it. So there's other infrastructure. We passed a couple of 218s back in 2006 and 2007. There was 218s that were passed to address that goes along Main Street, the main line for the wastewater plant. We were supposed to fix that, and we passed a 218. That's before we were going to move the waste plant from where it was. And so some of that was supposed to, you know, money was generated to fix that problem, and we haven't got there yet. That's another, what I hear, you know, focus on Morro Bay and the issues of the Morro Bay and our streets, you know, our crumbling streets.
And I know Jen the other day was talking about the infrastructure along the waterfront, the crumbling embankments. What's the plan there?
Over the years, we have passed measures to address issues such as you just mentioned, the streets and, Measure D for schools and improvement in different areas of our city. But what hasn't really been addressed until more recent days is our infrastructure on the waterfront. And it is crumbling. And I believe climate change is real. And I believe that we need to take action in order for us to be prepared for those long-lasting effects that are coming. One of those is raising tides and marking tides are stronger than ever, and what's already crumbling is going to crumble that much faster. It's not just what's happening inside the water, but it's also our waterfront street and our bathroom, our public restrooms, our circulation, our sidewalk conditions. There's just a lot that needs to be addressed. It's a huge problem, and we have to start somewhere. If we keep saying, yes, it's a huge problem, one day we'll fix it, we'll never get there. We have to address the situation now, and we need to start preparing for basically categorizing and seeing what those needs are, which are the most important at this point, and you know, some that can wait, but basically assessing the waterfront, the needs, the budget that's needed, and coming up with solutions. There's already been a few that are in the works. Paid parking is one of the issues that has been brought to council, and we agreed to start a pilot program that will hopefully start soon that will help with generating more revenue on the waterfront by having turnover within our parking, which really does bring in more foot traffic to our businesses. And then we see that money come in. Our tourism dollars are extremely important for our city. And I know a lot of people say, well, I don't really use the waterfront, so why do we need to really put money into it? I don't really care about it. I stay over in my side of town. I don't use it. I don't want to pay taxes, or I don't want to look at that. That's not my problem. But I always remind them that the waterfront is all of our problem. It is all of our concern. And that reason is, if you use it, great. If you don't, it still affects your streets. It affects your police department. It affects your fire department. It affects all the different things that your tax dollars go to and that those tourist tax dollars go to.
And the revenue could be melded into the city itself. It doesn't have to be turned around and spent on the waterfront.
Well, it depends. It depends on what it is. I mean, there's a measure out there right now that was citizen-driven, and that would be waterfront only. I'm not pushing that. You know, that's not what I'm here to talk about. But, you know, measures like that could parcel tax, that sort of thing, that would be waterfront only, right? That would be harbor only. But there's other, and the paid parking is also waterfront only. It goes back into maintenance and the infrastructure there. However, there are other creative ideas out there that I've heard from the community that I would love to further dive into that may not be specific to waterfront, but I think really overall, those tax dollars that that do come from our tourists that come for the harbor, they may not spend all of their money on the harbor. They spend it in other areas. And so overall, yes, we do see that tax money throughout our city.
James,
the waterfront, the Embarcadero, very important to Morro Bay. That's what makes Morro Bay so unique. We have this little harbor right here. Mm-hmm. So we can't do without that. And there's been a lot. Actually, it's been neglected. I wish we would have brought this forward a long time ago and paid more attention. The infrastructure is, you know, it needs some loving care, so to speak. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to do. See, some of those leases are responsible for that. And they're doing some building down there right now. One of my questions was, is the seawall going to be, or that revetment right there, is that going to be built up a little bit to accommodate? Because we know there's going to be sea rise. Has that been addressed? That wasn't. So I don't know what we're waiting for on that. So that was one of the things, you know, we could have done that as a city to, you know, require that, since that is being, there's some parcels down there that are being reworked. Why not incorporate that in there and see if we can't do more? And there's been some other things. You know, the Harbor Department's really been doing a great job. They're doing all they can with what little they have. And their job of safety, public safety, they do outstanding. You know, you got to hand it to them. I really appreciate them. But there's more the city can do, I think. I don't know necessarily that the parking's going to be the answer to that. So if you do that parking program, they were supposed to do a study on that first to see how the feasibility of that. And they're going to do the paid parking pilot program. But that money can only be used, you know, it's specific to that. It can be used for sidewalks and stuff. So it can't be reverted back to the city, can't use that, but it'll need to stay on the Embarcadero.
I attended the candidates night when you guys spoke. What I'm missing is, how are you guys opponents?
When you're looking to see who you want on your council, I think it's important to have as much diversity as possible. When you're deciding on who to vote for, I think it's important that the diversity that I bring is that I am a woman. I am under the age of 50. I'm a current business owner who has my finger on the pulse in our business community. I am involved with community groups throughout our entire county, but especially here in Morro Bay. I've been involved in community groups such as Friends of the Harbor Department since they started, and other groups. I think that it's important that we look at that when we're deciding on who to vote for, because as you said, Tom, we do agree on a lot. But I think that when it comes to experience and leadership and my involvement in the community, that stands out.
All right, James, what do you bring to the table that she does not?
Well, you know, I have a different approach on things. Like I said, I want the community to be more involved, mm-hmm. and I want the community to know what the city has planned, not after they've already planned it, but before, so we can get the input on. Mm-hmm. And I've been a longtime resident. I met my wife down on Front Street. It used to be Central Coast Seafood. Mm-hmm. So I met my wife there 37 years ago or so, but I used to work on the dock there. It was a great time, man. I loved pulling all that fish. We used to get so much fish over there back when Morro Bay was a fishing community. So I've been involved with this community for a long time too, and as a business owner. So I know what's going on in the city. And so I'm a stakeholder here in town. I have a home here. And so I want Morro Bay to continue as Morro Bay is, the quaint town that it is. And so we need to keep that.
To learn more about James Costanzo's world and your website?
It's James Costanzo Morro Bay .com. You know, I'm not a big internet guy. I'm an old, I'm not a big techie, so
and
you can find that.
Jen Ford, to learn more about you.
Yeah, you can find me at jenford.org. We made it pretty simple, but I'm also on Instagram and Facebook as well. And you can always email me at jen@jenford.org. I'd love to chat with you, meet with you, have a coffee, whatever. But yeah, I would love to hear from you.
And I'm Tom Wilmer. We've been visiting with two candidates for City Council, City of Morro Bay, James Costanzo and Jen Ford. We'll see you at the polls on the 7th of June.
The ballots actually got mailed out, and if you don't get them, contact your city clerk.
Festival Mosaic's summer concerts start in June. Here's KCBX's Dr. Consuelo Mukes.
Welcome to the Nonprofit Story. This is Dr. Consuelo Mukes, your host. Today I have with me Lloyd Tanner. He is the executive director of Festival Mosaic, and he is here to tell us about the new concert series coming up, as well as some background on Festival Mosaic. So, Lloyd, welcome to the Nonprofit Story.
Thank you for having me.
You're so welcome. It's exciting to have you here because you represent one of the most wonderful music organizations here in San Luis Obispo County. You have your 50th anniversary book out.
We were supposed to celebrate our 50th anniversary in 2020, the summer of 2020. Obviously, we weren't able to have that experience that we were hoping for. But yes, Festival Mosaic has been a part of San Luis Obispo County's community for over 50 years now. It began back in the day with Cliff Swanson and the Mozart Festival, and then 35 years later, Scott Yu became our music director. Festival Mosaic really is an organization that's committed to bringing some of the finest musicians and artists from around the country and literally from around the world to our community so that you don't have to go down to Los Angeles, you don't have to go to San Francisco to experience these great musicians. But at the same time, they get to come and experience our wonderful town and our wonderful community and almost without fail fall in love with this place and the people that come here, that live here and support the arts.
Mm-hmm. And I think you have some artists that want to come back a second time even, don't you?
We have artists who like just planned on staying if they could. So we're very fortunate to have the extra things in life that musicians and artists tend to sort of gravitate towards. Beautiful outdoors experiences, mm-hmm. wonderful food, and of course some pretty tasty wines.
Absolutely. So, Lloyd, let's talk about it then. Festival Mosaic, is it actually a season? Is it ongoing?
It originated as a summer festival. It was a way for Cliff and his musician friends to have something to do in the summer and, you know, to prepare for this next season of symphonic works, both for the symphony as well as at Cal Poly University's music department. It was called the Mozart Festival, but it was never just a Mozart festival. It's always been quite eclectic in its programming and its guest artist. The heart of it is a chamber music festival, but we really embrace that sort of mosaic name that we got changed to, with the idea that when we do want to explore other genres, other musicians, we are trying to bring some of the very best that we can. So when we do Broadway, we want to do Broadway at a big level. When we do bluegrass, we want to do bluegrass at a big level.
Yeah, expand it out now with some jazz. And I know you have a lot of contemporary and opera. I mean, just all sorts of wonderful genres.
It gives a lot of leeway to sort of embrace an opportunity when it presents itself so that we're not completely locked into just doing chamber music or just doing vocal music or doing jazz music. We can when we have someone who's available, we can say that's definitely a Festival Mosaic artist.
And you have some wonderful locations that you hold events at too.
I would say that is equally as important to our mission to be a part of the full county, you know, from Chandon to Napomo, Los Osos to here in San Luis Obispo City. Our ability to pack up, and we call it the traveling circus sometimes, and go to to Paso Robles to do a concert on the square at the gazebo is a really unique part of who we are, because we are literally trying to bring the music and our musicians to your part of the county as well.
Mm-hmm. Lloyd, what makes Festival Mosaic maybe different than some of the other organizations that provide such wonderful music for us here in the county?
First, we have so many amazing organizations that are part of San Luis Obispo. The symphony has been around for over 75 years. The opera, you know, does incredible work. We have some amazing dance companies. I think there's three for a town this size. It's amazing. The museum is doing wonderful presentations. Festival Mosaic, I think, is a slightly different, is that we bring in musicians and artists from outside to our community for them to experience it. Our artist in residence, for example, this year was Abigail Kralik, a young Hungarian-American violinist. New York Juilliard trained, currently based in Berlin, Germany, but who loves coming here and being a part of performing with Scott, but also has grown to love San Luis Obispo and really considers it one of her favorite places, you know, during her concertizing year. So I think that that's what separates us slightly. But at the same time, I think we're all trying to, you know, raise the boats, so to speak, so that whenever we do have, when Scott comes into town and he's performing, we want to make sure that some of our local musicians are a part of the festival, that we have that chance to sort of make sure that we're doing our part to engage the community as much as just bringing people in to perform.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot of detail, I think, that might go into planning, bringing people here from even overseas. Who does the planning and how does it all get done?
You know, we're a nonprofit organization, so we're pretty lean and mean, as we like to say. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a staff of three people, myself, Dave George, and one of our newest people, Jackie Yeager. Scott Yu is our artistic and music director, and really sort of comes up with sort of the overall idea of what he wants to do, not only in the summertime, but as a full season, as that arc is being developed. You know, thinking of what kind of guest artists we would like to bring, what kind of repertoire we would like to do, how the artist in residence program will affect, you know, that, you know, what they're going to want to bring in. But it is really, truly a collaborative effort between the full team. I would like to think that we all have a input into who we're bringing and what kind of repertoire we're performing. But at the end, you know, Scott has to have his stamp of approval and get excited about what we're going to bring. But it is, again, having come from larger organizations, you know, that have full departments that are focused on fundraising, focused on production, focused on marketing, when you're wearing all those hats at one time, it's definitely a new experience for me.
Yeah, well, that's great that you even decided to come and do this for us, Lloyd, but I know you're quite a musician yourself. I hear that you had a trombone performance as part of your schooling, right?
Yeah, I have a wonderful degree from Southern Methodist University in trombone performance.
Can you remember what your favorite composer was when you did your senior recital?
Well, Hindemith would have been mine, yeah. I mean, he was he's an interesting composer. He doesn't get performed enough. He is not as challenging as people think he is. But what I found really fascinating about him as a composer is that he created a sonata for piano and an instrument for every instrument of the orchestra, not only for us to be able to have, you know, an opportunity to have to perform it, but it was a way that he trained himself to understand the limits and the capabilities of each of the instruments. So as he was orchestrating his bigger works, he had a much more profound knowledge in terms of the how each instrument worked. But yeah, he's my favorite composer for the trombone in the world with Bruckner and Brahms and Beethoven, you know, as well. So,
well, you know, it's so good that you did that and told us about it, because I think one of the nice things about Festival Mosaic is that there's the opportunity for the audience to learn about the music from the artist who will get up and maybe say something, or yourself or others.
You know, what I've found really interesting as I've got to know the festival even more, our notable encounter experience that Scott sort of created whenever he came on board, this idea of the curated lecture recital, know before you go kind of thing, is not necessarily unique to Festival Mosaic, but Scott Yu does it at a level that I've never seen anyone else be able to do. It's entertaining, it's personable, it's not speaking down to or speaking over. He has created an amazing knack for helping you know what both the musician is doing in the performance as well as what the composer may have been thinking of whenever he wrote it. And that insight is so interesting, to be able to go on a Friday night and see them discuss that piece, and then Sunday afternoon when you hear the performance, you have just a little bit of knowledge that helps you through that piece, especially if it's unfamiliar or if it's something that you've listened to a, you know, 100 times.
I mean, been to some of those, and you just feel so a part of the whole festival when you get that kind of information. So what is coming up? I know you're getting ready to have your summer season. What's coming up?
Yeah, I mean, the summer season is on sale. It's an 8-day festival this year, still making baby steps to getting back to the full experience. But in those 8 days, we have over 20 events in some 13 different venues and 6 or 7 cities.
Wow,
so it'll be a very busy week mm-hmm. for all of us and for the team. But before that, we have a couple of what we're calling our sort of mosaic late night series, with some more, you know, alternative and maybe a little more experimental artists. It's in collaboration with our friends over at Slow Brew Rock. And we're bringing a young woman by the name of Rachel Bayman, who is a singer-songwriter and Americana artist. And then we have two young women, Emily Wells and Caitlin Ariella Smith, who are electronic artists who do things with synthesizers and looping and visual artists at the same time. Really a unique experience to sort of challenge, hopefully I challenge our audience to step out of their comfort zone a little bit, and then also maybe introduce some new people to who Festival Mosaic is in a grander scale.
So it sounds like you have something for everybody.
You know, again, you know, not to bring back the Mosaic name, but again, it gives us an excuse to really try to create a big umbrella, so that maybe you come to us because you're a big fan of jazz and Christian McBride is someone that you can't believe is going to be at Cuesta College in a 400-seat theater performing during the festival. But then you take a look and you're like, oh my gosh, I never even thought about going to see a chamber music concert at the Mission. We like to think that there's something for everyone. You know, prices, you know, we try to keep the prices available so that there's an entry point for both people who want the front row and people who just like to be in the audience.
Okay, now on the tickets, what are the price ranges, and are there ways for everyone to see if they can be able to afford a ticket?
Pricing the ticket as an art form and also a little bit of just instinct. You know, we try to keep our average ticket prices between $45 and $50. So what that means for the ticket buying audience is that, yeah, there'll be some, there are seats that are $75 and there are seats that are $35. We try to have programs for students to be able to, you know, have the opportunity to experience these artists, you know, at $5. And even, you know, on the orchestra concert with Alain Grimon on the 30th of July, you know, we have tickets starting at $10. Hmm. So, you know, I'm very aware of that. Our family concert, which is the Carnival of the Animals at the PAC, all the tickets are $5. A family of four can go for $20. I do believe that it's important that people put a value on the arts, because these musicians and dancers have spent, you know, their life really trying to perfect and give a performance that is worthy of both your time and your investment. But at the same time, I'm really proud that we're able to overall always have an entry point for anyone who price may be a challenge.
That's good. That is a wonderful thing that there's that consideration. So if people do want to find out more about the festival, how can they do that?
We're always available to take your call at 805-781-3009, but you can get a lot of information at Festival Mosaic, and that's mosaicwithaz.org.
Mosaicwithaz.org. Well, I think one other fun thing about Festival Mosaic is that some of the artists actually get to stay in the homes of some of the people in the area.
Exactly. The families that host have been hosting some of them for literally the entire length of the festival itself. And what happens is that the musicians make a relationship with a family, and year after year, that's who they stay with, and they look forward to it. They, you know, they get the Christmas card and really have enjoyed, you know, some great relationships and friendships.
So it really is a community group of people and musicians all together that Festival Mosaic helps to bring together here in our county.
We would not be able to do it without the strength and love and appreciation that our community gives to the festival. Just from the volunteers to the host families to the people who buy the tickets and to the donors who help make it all possible. It is truly a love of San Luis Obispo and everyone that lives here.
So tickets are on sale now?
Tickets are available. We believe in buying early and often.
Okay. And so when does the actual season start?
This summer's festival is from July 23rd through the 30th. We have a lot of wonderful performances and hope to see a lot of people at each of them.
Lloyd, just tell us one more time the website.
Our website is Festival Mosaic, and that's mosaic with a Z, .org.
This is Consuelo Mukes, your host with The Nonprofit Story. I've been speaking with Lloyd Tanner. He is the executive director of Festival Mosaic.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.